welcome to a study in the book of Hebrews. Our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa, is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today, he looks at Hebrews chapter 8, verses 3 through 5. Here's Dr. Ken Boa.
As we are looking at Hebrews 8, we observed that this chapter is focusing on the idea of a better covenant. He's dealing with the concept of Jesus as being a higher order of priests insofar as it is the order of Melchizedek. And he's emphasizing that as well, that was chapter 7, that in chapter 8 we have a better covenant. It's administered by a superior high priest, as we can see from 8:1. And we observed in our last time together a variety of attributes of Jesus about his finished work and about his enthronement to the right hand of the Father and about his supreme exaltation over all things. And so as the text said, the main point in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. A minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord picked, not men. So he's referring to a true sanctuary, a true tabernacle. He's been referring to the fact that this exalted high priest, who's taken his seat at the right hand of the majesty on high, ministers as well, not in an earthly, but in a heavenly sanctuary. He goes on to say, for every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, so it is necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. So what we see is this, that if Jesus is a superior high priest, if he is the one who has finished his work, because we know very clearly that in the Old Testament, Hebrews 7:19 summarizes, the law made nothing perfect. But here, if we have a perfect high priest, we have one who now satisfies the requirements of God, unlike the sacrificial system, he, as you know, coming from above, becomes both the priest and the offering. Both the giver and the gift are one and the same. And it's one of the many, many uniquenesses of the Christian and the biblical vision that God is the one who comes down to us, not us trying to work our way up to him. It's a very, very different idea that it's God who reaches down to us, becomes one of us, so that we can then become children of God. I think C.S. Lewis put it along those lines that the Son of God became a son of man so that the sons of men can be sons of God. And the idea then is that we have a purpose and we have a calling and an incredible price that was paid. And as you know, the worth of a thing is what someone's willing to pay for it. I'm often astounded at what I hear people pay for and things like on eBay and things for ridiculous things. The worst example I ever heard of was a $28,000 grilled cheese sandwich. Because it appeared to have an image of Jesus or something like that on it. When I'm pretty confident that was, first of all, the image was a little bit amorphous. And even there, if I took one of those little soldering kits that I used to have, remember the little woodworking things that would burn things, you could just burn the toast by not touching it and make any pattern you want. But that's not, I was thinking of really going into the business, you know, I could create all kinds of wonderful artifacts. But the fact is, apparently it was worth that because somebody was dumb enough to pay for it. The fact is then that in this case, what might be precious to one is worthless to another. But here's the thing. The issue of worth is determined by God, not us. And that is where the difference is. Jonathan Edwards made it very clear. The wisest thing you can do is to treat things according to their true value. And that you treasure that which is, in fact, valued by God. And that you disdain those things which God says are really worthless in the end. Which means we have to embrace an entirely different value system. The fact is that we have great value because this high priest then offers his own blood on our behalf, and so that's an infinite purchase price. But could a priest who has finalized his work minister from a covenant that could finish nothing? And so his argument's going to be that it's a better covenant. Just as there is a better priesthood, so it is a better covenant. Because this covenant has to accomplish, it has to finish something. The old covenant could make nothing perfect. It's the new covenant that's necessary to make something and render it perfect. And so our high priest in heaven then demands a superior covenant, and that's where the argument will go. He's going to be saying it's ministered in a superior place. In verse 3, every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, so it is necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. Just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle, "For see," he says, "that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown to you on the mountain." Now, let me pull a few things out of those rich verses. First of all, we see that it is argued to be a better covenant, but it's also in a better place. And this concept is very important because you see the Jews, at this time that this book was written, this epistle was written, the sanctuary in Jerusalem was still there. When was it destroyed? What year? Most of you will know. 70 AD. It was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. So this was written prior to that, which meant that the Jews had an option of going up to a very palpable, visible, tangible sanctuary. They could see that. They could see the offerings being made. And there's always this temptation for us to go with what we can see and to treasure that above what we do not see. Isn't it true? That's human nature. It's been described in that way by Francis Schaeffer many years ago. He used a phrase in one of the first books I read after I became a Christian. It was Escape from Reason. And he wrote that thing in 1968. And the phrase still resonates when he said, "Nature eats up grace." Doesn't that sound like an odd phrase? What that means is this: the natural, what's palpable, visible, tangible, and measurable, has a way of occluding that which is not visible and tangible and measurable. That is to say, what is seen after a while in this world system seems to take dominance over what is unseen. And this, for example, is why we go back and we treat the church as more of an organization than it really is in Scripture as an organism. You see, the tail begins to wag the dog. We begin to pursue those things that are visible and tangible rather than those things which are not. Similarly, the temptation would be to continue the system that is at least visible. How do we know he's up there in the heavenlies? How do we know that there's a sanctuary up there? And so he's going to be arguing and saying that in line of this, these are good questions that one raises, and there are answers that we can have. There's a logical answer, first of all, in verse 3. Let me reread that text. Here he says, every high priest, and by the way, the high priest is not an honorific. It's actually a term that describes what he is doing, that he is there to accomplish something. He is there to serve. Every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, so it is necessary that this high priest must have something to offer. But where could he offer it if he's not on earth? And so he's developing his argument along those lines. We know, for example, from chapter 5:1, if we just flip back a couple of pages, verse 1 in chapter 5 says that every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. So he's using that same idea of gifts and sacrifices being offered for sins. And then we see that same idea repeated in 7:27, just a few verses before our present one. He who does not need daily, like these high priests, to offer up sacrifices for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, because this he did once for all when he offered up himself. But this idea then is that the priest is the one who represents the people before God and God before the people. That would be the idea of a priest. He would be one who would represent the people before God by offering up the sacrifices. And in effect, then it symbolizes their own corporate sin. But then he would represent God before the people in the service of the sanctuary. So there was a whole notion of service. And a priest would serve for 20 years full time. And then they would be assistants. It was between the ages of 30 and 50. Talk about a short job career, you know, short job track. But they never retired, by the way. But this is parenthetical. You know I don't believe in retirement, don't you? Do you know that? Now, it doesn't mean that you don't retire from your career necessarily, but you don't retire from your ministry. You don't retire from life. You don't retire from service. You never retire from that. Never buy into the mindset of retirement as something now you're just going to sit back and do nothing. or just please yourself. That is really a poor, poor stewardship. That is to squander all that God's given you. In fact, my view is people in the, quote, retirement years, which I don't like that term, in those, quote, years, are kind of put out to pasture, or they even put themselves out to pasture, and the only things that, the things that they provide of tremendous value, what do they have? What resources do they bring to the table? They bring tremendous experience and wisdom, hard-learned lessons, do they not? They also have some time that they didn't have before and resources that they did not before. What do they think? What do you think they've been given that for? Not to squander it on themselves, but to invest it in others. Everything you've received is meant to be given to others, ultimately. And that is the idea. So always understand your vocare, which is the word, Latin word, which means that we use the word vocation. The word vocare means calling. Your calling transcends your career. You see? Just as your career these days transcends just one particular job. And so the idea is that you never lose your vocare, you never lose your calling. We have this calling from God. That was just a little sidebar. But every so often, it's good to say something along those lines. So we see then that the conclusion is logical. That if Jesus, as he's demonstrated, is our true high priest, if he in fact is the one who is ministering on our behalf, then it means that as a high priest, he would be offering up gifts and sacrifices on us, for us, and that would have to take place in the heavenly sanctuary. Now, it's important for us to see, though, that this imagery of offering both gifts and sacrifices, the term in this case applied to Christ, is the idea of offer, which is in the aorist tense, which basically means it's a once for all. It is not like he's continually doing that, but he presents that, having offered this once for all. But it's like the imagery of something that abides forever. That offering now continues forever. It's not like he has to re-offer and re-offer, but rather it was a once for all gift that he had and gave to us. That's why he could sit down at the right hand rather than continuing to stand and work. You see the concept? So that there is both the idea that he has completed his work, and yet there's the idea of the ongoing impact of his work that never stops. And that's why he fulfills the imagery of what a high priest would be doing. And we see this, for example, in 9:24 through 28. He makes this very clear. If there was any doubt, jump ahead a little bit to where we're going to be going. 9:24, Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the one, of the true one, but rather, it says, he went into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he would offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place year by year with the blood that is not his own. Otherwise, he would have had needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. In other words, he'd have to be constantly sacrificed and sacrificed throughout the foundation of the world to fulfill that purpose. But now, once, as the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And then he goes on to make this important statement, inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment. By the way, there's a verse against reincarnation. You don't go around again. Life is enough time, and then after this, there's judgment. So Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. So it's very, very clear. It's a very tight and carefully reasoned argument that he's developing. So he's saying, yes, there is a sanctuary, and there is a better covenant. And the better covenant points to a better priest, and it points to, in fact, the idea of a better sanctuary, and the sanctuary not built with men. Now, he uses a logical answer then to say if he is a high priest, he has to be offering gifts, and that has to be there since it cannot be on earth, it has to be in heaven. But then he goes back to a little bit of a summary of an argument that he made earlier. It's in verse 4. And this is really a genealogical argument. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law. We saw from Hebrews 5 and also Hebrews 7 that if he were on earth, he would not be allowed to go into the sanctuary as a priest. That's very clear. Why? We know that Messiah comes from Judah. The kingly line comes from Judah, but certainly no priest ever did. Yet Psalm 110 says, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, and that was David who said that. So clearly then, we have the idea that if he were on earth and ministering there, he would not be allowed to do so. Yet another reason why it has to be in the heavenlies, you see, this concept. So this is a very rich and decisive argument that he's giving us. Now he goes on to argue from what you might call a typological point of view, where he looks at the idea of a type and the anti-type. Let me explain. Jumping to verse 5, he says, let me go back to the other, who offer gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. Just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle, see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown to you on the mountain. And that reference back to Exodus is a reference back to the fact that this was something that was revealed to you as a type on the holy mountain. And that word for type, tupos, from which we get the word type, it would be transliterated like that. That word really means something that anticipated in the old what was now fulfilled in the new. And the New Testament refers to a number of these types. You don't want to be going back when there's no New Testament support for this by picking everything in the Old Testament saying, oh, that's a type, that's a type, that's a type. But the New Testament reveals a great deal of what's in the Old along those lines of types and anti-types, an anti-type being that which preceded it, which fulfilled it, rather, in a type then, this idea of something that was before and something that was after. At any rate, the concept is that the old is in the new revealed, the new is in the old concealed. Remember that idea? Did I get that backwards? I think I did. I think the new is in the old revealed. No, that's right. Yeah, the new is in the old concealed. The old is in the new revealed. That's the way you want it. That's why I never tell people to read the Old Testament until they've read the New Testament three times. Worst thing you can do if you're a new Christian, start in Genesis 1. Very poor mistake, because you'll really struggle. At least you have a storyline, but then when you get to Exodus, you're going to get into all kinds of details about the tabernacle and the offerings and so forth. Leviticus really makes it worse, and you'd lose your sanity if you didn't know where you're going with that. And even if you survive Leviticus, you're back into the same thing with Deuteronomy. It would just be a real mess. Then when you get out of the historical books, you say, where'd my story go? And you get into the poetics and so forth. So really, I tell people always, always to read the New Testament three times, and then you're ready to really understand the Old Testament as we need to see it. Because the Old Testament now is fully illuminated by the New. That's the concept. And I always tell people, start with the Gospel of John, and then after you've read John, a book to read might be Romans. You know, just start where the central things are, and then move from there into the other portions of the New Testament until you have that down a lot better. Then we're ready to see that. So we certainly see an awful lot of typology. And we know this is true because the New Testament affirms this. Typology in terms of the feasts of Israel. Typology in terms of the tabernacle and temple. And it's an intriguing study to talk about the feasts and also the tabernacle, because it's rich in the way they portray the whole way of redemption. It's incredible, really. And the New Testament discusses this in a variety of ways. And therefore, we see that idea of what was in the past, something that's now being fulfilled in the future. So the past is like a shadow of a future reality. And that's why he's saying you don't go back to the shadow, but you instead cling to the substance. It makes no sense once you've embraced the substance to go back to a shadowy world that just portends but doesn't really fulfill. And so we see this concept then when he goes on to say that we serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. You know what that means then? A copy is something, there's something that's there that we're now copying. And if you were to make the copy the reality, it'd be like trying to live in the blueprint rather than in the building. You see the concept? There is the idea that there is a symbolism. This is what language is about, by the way, as well. For example, your DNA. You didn't think I'd get into that, did you? One of the things I just did at the Centurions, I did my presentation of the powers of 10. Boy, was that a challenge to boil that down to 1 hour. But I managed to do it. But I talk about each order of magnitude. I got to go all the way down, 18 orders of magnitude down to a point where you get to 10 to the minus 18th meters, and then work my way all the way back. I go inside the proton, inside the quarks when I do this. And then I go back up and work myself back up to the ordinary world, and we work ourselves up 26 more orders of magnitude, up to the last slide, which is 10 billion light years across. And what I try to do is to have a variety of supplemental slides that describe what's going on in each of these orders of magnitude. And there, in fact, each is its own little world, and each has its own rules and its order. It's phenomenal. At any rate, when you go down to the level of DNA, you're now no longer dealing with life, are you? You see, DNA is not alive. Once you get down below the level of the cell itself, now you have something that's non-living. It's basically a biochemistry, but it's that material. Your DNA is not alive, yet it codes for life. It's an amazing concept. Bill Ibsen and I are creating a presentation on the human body, and it'll be a seminar. This is going to be big because it's going to go through every one of the systems of the human body. And one of the things we observe when we consider the number of particles we have and then the DNA, it's just utterly phenomenal. You know, 100 trillion cells in your body. Each of the 100 trillion cells has about 100 trillion atoms. It's almost it's 10 to the 8th more atoms in your body, than there are stars in the cosmos. And they are replaced within five years. So you don't even have the same atoms you had a few years ago. Yet the body continues on. It's a really remarkable thing. But when you what's that? When will it be finished? The body is constantly replacing itself. When will it be finished? I was going to say, no, actually, it's wearing out in this world. It won't be finished. I was going to say, it won't be finished till the resurrection. And that's when it'll be finished. And it may be that the same is true of my presentation. That might not be ready until heaven, so we have to wait and see. But no, it's halfway through. It's halfway completed. And then we have four physicians that are going to kind of give it an overview and look over it to make sure our facts are correct. But one of the things that really struck me when you consider the DNA in each of your 100 trillion cells, which actually is so finely compacted that it could be teased out to be 6 feet long, how it spirals and spirals within coils, within coils, within coils, and how it opens and closes thousands of times every second to create these new messenger RNAs. It's just utterly phenomenal how rich and amazing it is. And if you could take all the DNA in all your 100 trillion cells, and if you could stretch it end to end, you know how long that would reach? 600 times to the sun and back. 600 times, and that's in you. Yet your DNA in your body weighs 1/1,000,000 of an ounce. And if you take all the DNA of all 6 billion people on the planet, you know what it all would add up to? It would add up to 1/1,000th of an ounce. Think about that for a moment. All this information, your code, your genome, has all the information that expresses itself in your body. And it actually has the information that, even though it's not alive, has the information that creates that which is alive. It's absolutely fundamental and mind-boggling as far as I'm concerned. Information transcends the medium itself. And so in the same way, then, the DNA is a language, because a language, by its definition, always has symbolic content for an actual reality. You see the concept? For example, what does a map do? A map isn't the thing itself, but it is a kind of language that corresponds to something out there. You see? So a map of the city of Atlanta isn't Atlanta, but it is a language for and symbolic of information about Atlanta. Similarly, a musical score is a language insofar as it directly corresponds to vibrations of sound and describes how those are to be sequenced and developed. So we can see that. Similarly, your DNA is a language because the actual genome corresponds through the genes themselves to the development of very specific features in your body, though no one knows quite how this little change makes that macro effect. It's absolutely mysterious. The more you learn, by the way, about the world, the more mysterious it becomes. Alice in Wonderland was right when she said, curiouser and curiouser. And that's how it is. The older I'm getting, the more I realize how little I know. The more I realize how mysterious everything is. And so the idea here is, going back to that, then take the idea of the thing that Moses received. See to it that you build everything according to the pattern that you saw on the mountain. And that word tupas is the word that we're seeing here as that he's referring to. The type that you saw on the mountain. The thing is that you're going to build that tabernacle and later the temple will not be the thing itself that's in heaven, but it'll be a kind of a representation. So in that case, the real thing's in heaven and the symbol is on earth. You see the concept there? So we only see the world of shadows and symbols right now in this planet, but there we will see the real substance. That's why I tell you that the things that are seen are not the things that really endure. It's the things that are unseen that endure forever, as we know from 2 Corinthians 4. And so we move on to this, and we see then that Moses saw a pattern, and it needed to be fulfilled. We know from Revelation 19, by the way, that the Old Testament tabernacle, that there is a temple of God in heaven. It's quite intriguing. He's speaking out from his holy temple. Imagery of Revelation describes a variety of things. In Revelation 6, 9 to 11, it describes a brazen altar, as well as an altar of incense in Revelation 8, 3 through 5. The sea of glass reminds us of the laver, you see. And the seven lamps of fire suggest the seven branched candlestick, the lampstand in the tabernacle. Those things that were in the tabernacle are suggestive of what's in heaven. It's interesting, however, that while there is a, quote, temple, that he's in the temple in Revelation, that temple will no longer exist in the eternal state in Revelation 21 and 22, because now the entire city of God is a temple. And the bride of Christ, which is the city of God, in other words, the bride, when we see her, is this extraordinary city. And it is like that now there's no need for a temple. He is among us and in us and with us. You see the concept? So there is a progression and a development. But the bottom line of this argument then is, since Christ is ministering in the original sanctuary and not the copy, he's ministering in a better place. That's what he's arguing. It's a better covenant and it's a better sanctuary. And we have to understand then that this better sanctuary is needful because it's the real thing, whereas what we see on earth is just the types and the shadows themselves. So he's given us two strong evidences of the superiority of this new covenant, that it's ministered by a superior priest, Jesus Christ, and it's ministered by in a superior place. Where is it? In heaven itself. And so he's going to develop his argument further and talk about how it also relates to superior claims and promises of God. And we'll see that in verses 6 to 13. So we're going to go to the end of the chapter and we'll see how that argument is developed, where it's going to be based upon superior promises as well. So we've seen his argument then. It's quite a cumulative argument insofar as he says that Jesus is a superior person and he has a superior priesthood, and then he's going to be saying that he also offers a superior life, a superior power, you might want to do. If you like alliteration, some people love alliteration, don't they? So you have to have three P's, you know. So here we go. Yeah, superior person, priesthood, and power. You like that? So we can summarize the book of Hebrews, because when you get into chapter 10, now you're moving into the power, the idea of what this actually, 11 rather, moves into the power that we have, that we did not have in the Old Covenant at all. I see I have a few minutes here, because I didn't want to get into this third part. I want to develop 6 through 13 in one collective. So this gives us one of our rare opportunities to have a Q&A. And by the way, I every so often, and I haven't been doing this of late, like to do just a Q&A with you every so often. So I'll do that fairly soon with you, where we can have a whole session. And I'll probably try to let you know when that'll be so you can write some questions down and know what you'd like to say. Yes. She's asking that this might be too long a question, but could you refer to what's in the tabernacle and the answer would be very long, but because what you'd find is all the pieces of furniture in the tabernacle correspond to spiritual truth, redemption. It's a portrait of redemption. You would discover as well that the tabernacle itself, the building, the outer courtyard, the inner place, the holy place, and the holy of holies, these two correspond in many ways. Some have related it, in fact, to body, soul, and spirit, and different kinds of things along those lines. The colors that are used indicate that you have the fusion of the divine and the human. It goes on and on. I actually am planning, Lord knows if I can do it, I have the materials for it, a presentation of the tabernacle, but it would be a visual presentation where I do a teaching of that, which would be a really fun thing because it's an eye-opener. And you realize how rich the Old Testament really is in terms of its symbolic imagery. But if I was going to do that, then I'd also have to do one on the seven feasts. Now, it happens that many years ago when I was working for Walk Through the Bible, I actually wrote a little booklet on the seven feasts of Israel, which if you're interested in getting, I think we have copies at the Reflections office. But it's amusing if you see that because it has a picture of me as what I looked like when I first came to Atlanta in 1979. And it's a very amusing picture. Yes. I think you were next, yeah.
What's the difference between the tabernacle and the temple?
Yeah. She's asking, what's the difference between the tabernacle and the temple? Both of them had a similar format and structure. The temple was substantially larger, and instead of being made out of wood and having the animal skins and all of those kinds of things, the materials themselves were different, and the scale was greater. And so instead of having, for example, the laver, it had the whole sea, and then it had 10 other smaller areas that would carry water, you see, for the little smaller lavers that would be used for the people themselves. It was much more elaborate, much more substantial, and very, very ornate indeed. And also, and here's the interesting point, it was permanent. The major difference between the two, apart from what I just pointed out, is that the tabernacle was a prefab building. Think about that. It's the first thing the world has ever seen. It was a prefab construction. And what they did is they had three basic subdivisions of Aaron. And each of those groups, Gershom, Merari, and what was the third one? Each of those, they had a different job. And as when the Spirit of God moved and the column of smoke or the pillar of fire would move, guess what they had to do? They had to break down their tents, but they also, these Levites, it was the duty of the Levites. One family of the Levites would take care of all the physical articles of the hard material. All the silver caps and the beams and the boards and all of that, they'd carry that. Another one of the families of Levi would carry the furniture. That's why it had these rings. Remember the rings that were in there? And they had poles because they were not allowed to touch the furniture. Remember what happened when someone once did that? Uzzah actually tried when it was in Philistia. Remember the Philistines had taken the Ark of the Covenant. And it's a funny story about how they got it back in some ways, because God struck them with these hemorrhoids and these tumors. And so they figured they made 5 golden tumors and they stuck them on there and said, get this thing out of here. It's obvious that this is a malice to us, you see. In fact, when it was there, their god Dagon fell down. And they'd try to pick them up and then they'd fall down and break again. You see, get this thing out of here. There's something wrong. And so when they tried to get it out of there, they didn't remember the law because they had not been accustomed to doing these things. And so they put it on a cart and then they tried to cart it off. And Uzzah tried to stabilize it when it almost fell over and he was zapped. And it seemed disproportionate, but the reason for it was a portrait of the holiness, and they were not doing it as it was called to do, you see. The idea is that you put, then they realized, they read, oh, this is what you're supposed to do. Put the poles in there. That way you can carry it. So they'd carry this in the wilderness. And then the third group would carry the outward coverings. You know, the tent and the skins and all of that. And they had their order. And if you actually look at Deuteronomy, you see how they were ordered. It was a cruciform pattern where they all were. There was one cross and then another cross within the other cross. And it was open to the east, as all churches, you know, all cathedrals are open to the east. That's where it would go in one entrance and so forth. And it would be set up very efficiently. So they got it down perfectly. So one group would set up, and then the next group would set up, and finally the third, you see. And then the third group would put in the furniture. And on it goes. Why was there a difference between the prefab and the permanent? Because the permanent was the idea that this is where my place will be. That's the place. That's the sanctuary. That is the place where I have made for my holy sanctuary. And so it became the idea of the permanence. And so it was not David himself who built it, because he was a man of warfare, although David is the one who amassed the resources for it, but rather it was Solomon who would be given the privilege of building that. And on it goes, but it's those are some of the differences. I think Bill, you were next.
I just read a book by Hank Hanford talking about titles. His argument was that the land itself in Israel was a title.
Right. He's saying that Hank Hanegraaff wrote a book on types. He was saying the land itself is a type. And there is a very real sense in which that is the case. Because land, by the way, was a part of the blessing, or part of the Abrahamic blessing, part of the covenant. And that the land itself, and that's why the imagery of crossing over into the land and the idea of the land of Israel then would have a very real sense. And so what you see in, for example, Ezekiel, particularly chapters 40 to 48, you actually see the boundaries of the land actually specifically described in great detail with the new temple that will be built in the millennium, and that this millennial temple will be there in Jerusalem, and it describes exactly what the boundaries of the land will be and so forth. This has, each of these always has a specific bearing to truth. There was a question there. Tom.
This morning you talked about Jesus being in heaven offering up.
Yes.
But there's a new heaven and a new earth. Where do we reside? Are we to be in the new earth or the new heaven, or can we move freely? What's going on?
Both, is my view. Now, I believe, if my eschatology is correct, I believe we will have 1,007 years in which we can see the cosmos in our resurrected bodies as it currently is before it is destroyed and a new heavens and new earth are made, and then we will have access to the entire new heavens and new earth. And that the city of God, this temple, this organic city, will somehow come down from heaven toward the earth. It never says it touches it, but coming down from heaven is the terminology. So it's, for me, a both and, where you can, if I'm correct, and in the kingdom, in the thousand-year kingdom, you would be in a resurrected body like Jesus was. But when he was on the earth, did anyone see that he had a resurrected body? They saw his body, touch and see, it's the same body, but it was a different body. You see the idea? It's a little bit like Gandalf, the imagery there, that remember Gandalf the gray becomes Gandalf the white? Remember that? Well, that's another. But the fact is that you have this same but different. But what happened when people saw Jesus not on earth? They'd be blown away. Paul in Damascus Road, John in Revelation 1. So here's what I suspect, is that when he was on the earth, and he was able, remember those 40 days of appearances, to manifest himself in an apparently unglorified form, a form that, in fact, it says in one place that he appeared in a different form. So people wouldn't know him unless he wanted them to know him. But the fact would be, though, that in the heavenly realms, he's glorious. Would it be possible, then, during that 1,000 years, for us, when we're in the heavenlies, to be glorious like the stars in the heavens, and then when we come to the earth, no one would be sure which one's which? Because the people in their physical bodies wouldn't know if you're one of them or not. Pure boa speculation, but it's an interesting thought. It's just pure boa speculation there. At any rate, I do see that it's, as far as I can see, a both and. You know, anything that we aspire to, and I look at these deep field photographs of the galaxies and the clusters of galaxies. One of my favorites is one that's called the Tadpole Galaxy, and I always use it in my Powers of Ten presentation. You see this wonderful galaxy. It looks like a tadpole, and it's enormous only because it's much closer to us than the field of galaxies behind. There are 6,000 galaxies in that photo, tiny little galaxies of all different colors and shapes and so forth. So I actually have made an appointment with a friend. We're going to go to this particular little red one there, and we're going to do that in 200 years. You see that? I do silly things like that. But the idea that I think God gives you a longing for something, you see, as an astronomer, I long to see this more fully. And I think we all would love to see that. And I think that corresponds. Anything that's good that we long for corresponds to something that will ultimately be fulfilled. It corresponds to a better reality. It's analogous to that. Yes?
I just get troubled when verses 8-7, where it says the first covenant had fault in it. And later on, it goes on to elaborate that the fault was with
Well, let me say the first part. He's saying he's concerned about the fact that the first covenant had fault in it. And the fault is in us, more or less, but he was going on to say.
From the scripture readings, why did God do it this way?
Why did God do it this way, then, from the scripture readings? My view is taken from Galatians, whereby Paul is saying that the law was never meant to save us or to perfect us, but only to point us to the need for grace. And that the law shows the character and holiness of God, but nothing could become perfect by trying to keep the law, because if that were the case, then Jesus died needlessly. So the law, it seems to me, is part of a progression of revelation that's preparing for Messiah himself, who himself would be the fulfillment of the law. And now that we have him in us and the power of the Spirit in us, now we who walk according to the Spirit, not according to the flesh, can be fulfillers of, we fulfill the requirements of the law, because the law can be summarized as loving of God and loving others and so forth. But when you walk, by the way, in the flesh, you lose that power. Now, you and I, therefore, have the ability to choose to walk and fulfill the law, because it's not us doing, it's Christ in us, the hope of glory. Or we can choose to walk in the flesh, but ultimately, we won't even be able to think sin. Right now, you remember at the beginning, they were able not to sin. Adam and Eve were able not to sin. Then after the fall, they were not able not to sin. And that's our condition before we know Christ. Am I correct? But then in Christ, we are now able not to sin again. But we wait for the glorious day when we will be not able to sin.
So really, the author shouldn't say that there's fault in the covenant, it's all.
No, what he's saying when he says fault, he's not using it in the way we would use it, but he's not. It can make nothing perfect. It doesn't lead to perfection or completion, would be the idea. It's not that the law itself was the problem, but the fault was with us itself. But the law can make nothing perfect, I think would be the major argument. I'm out of time. I'm sorry. We'll do this more. We'll do this another time. Every so often, it's good to have a little Q&A, though. Let me close in a prayer. Father, we thank you for this wonderful group of men and women who want to know you better, and I pray for each of them that they would, by your grace, come to know you better, to love you more, and to follow you in the way that bears much fruit. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.